Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This podcast is brought to you by SIGGRAPH Asia 2012, in Singapore from November 28th to December 1st. FX Guide is the official podcast of SIGGRAPH Asia.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. The FX Podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. This podcast is your opportunity to hear directly from the source, from the front lines of visual effects. Be sure to check out our other podcasts as well at fxguide.com/podcasts. Today we have a couple of treats in store for you. First, the subject of this week's podcast is an interview with Paul Franklin, visual effects supervisor on The Dark Knight Rises from Double Negative. Regular listeners will know that Paul Franklin is no stranger to the FX Podcast, as Mike Seymour has spoken with Paul about films from Inception, the Harry Potter films, to a discussion about DNEG's in-house tools. And he was part of our 200th episode where we featured the London Market. I said a couple of treats. The second one is that before we get to our podcast, I get to tell you about the new term over at FX PhD, our sister online training site that offers comprehensive visual effects training at prices you won't believe. So many great courses this term, I just want to highlight a few. One of the ones I'm looking forward to is VFX Foundations Part 2. Tal Naran is back with Part 2 of his course that is truly a course designed for everyone, from an absolute beginner to a career visual effects professional. This is seriously such a unique class that you'll want to head over to fxphd.com and read the full blurb just for this course. The first part of this course was amazing in the last term, and I know I'm looking forward to this one, as I said. Okay, let me just highlight a few more and we'll get into the interview. How about a new class, also with Tal Naran and Matt Leonard? An After Effects MoGraph course, an Intermediate Advanced Cinema 4D Motion Graphics class, Intermediate Houdini, Introduction to Houdini, PF Depth and PF Track class, an Introduction to Modo, and Arnold Renderer class. We'll also have a Production Effects class with Scott Squires. This is some of the stuff we covered in an intensive three-day workshop at the 3210 Studios, where ILM was born. This is another unique course talking in-depth about practical effects, the how and why kind of stuff from experienced masters. Plus, we're also adding Houdini and Arnold to the VPN list, where you can use our virtual private network to use the software during the duration of the classes. There's a full list of the VPNs available over at fxphd.com as well. So look for an FX Guide TV episode with a preview. You'll get to meet some of our great professors that way and get a quick overview of the classes. As I said, unique training, affordably priced. You just can't get this stuff anywhere else. All right, let's get on to the main event. Mike Seymour chatting with Paul Franklin about The Dark Knight Rises.
And I'm joined on the line by Paul Franklin. How are you, Paul?
I'm very well, Mike. Thank you very much.
So you've worked with this director a bit, but on more than just the Batman franchise. So it must feel, to a certain extent, very familiar territory, and of course be a rewarding experience to be able to sort of build up such a relationship of trust with a director, and for that matter, I guess, a whole crew.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we've been working with essentially the same core team since we started on Batman Begins back in late 2003. So by this point, it almost feels like we were working on one long continuous movie with breaks in between. And the familiarity you build up with, not only with Chris, but with the rest of the crew, all the other HODs, and means that there's none of that kind of awkward getting to know you sort of thing. There's none of the, we don't waste any time trying to work out each other's working methods or what people like or what they're going to be capable of doing or what they're intending to do. You've got a pretty instinctive feeling for how things are going to play out.
And of course, another really good aspect of this film is that, with the exception of some miniature work, all of the work was done by DNEG, and you were the visual effects supervisor. In fact, there was no sort of like studio supervisor and then a house supervisor. You were, directly working with Chris and your own company.
Yeah, I mean, I essentially had a dual role. I was the production supervisor and also Double Negative supervisor. And as you say, Double Negative did all of the digital work on the film, and with a two miniature moments being put together for us by New Deal Studios. And this is something that we'd established back on Inception. It was actually Chris's instigation. He called me up and asked me if I would be the VFX supervisor for Inception, and he was pretty keen to keep all the work in one place, if at all possible. I mean, he gave me the option to break things up, but it was clear that he wanted to simplify the process, to have one person that he could talk to who was really embedded in the team, who was actually doing the work.
So I've got to say that the thing that is just remarkable about seeing this film, and I was lucky enough to see it again in IMAX as I did the last film, is just the image quality at this high resolution. And having seen it, and of course part of the last film as well, of course, in IMAX, can you talk to me about, you know, the decision to shoot this much in IMAX, and then why stop short of shooting the whole thing in IMAX?
Well, the reason for IMAX is that Chris has always been looking to push the quality of the image. He is a real believer in film and I guess the traditional photochemical pipeline for filmmaking, and IMAX offers the highest possible image quality of any film format, any image format that has, you know, decent public exhibition systems. I mean, I'm sure there are some experimental digital systems which are higher resolution than IMAX, but in terms of something where there are actually installed cinemas and everything, it's IMAX is absolutely the last word. The apparent resolution of a really sharp IMAX image is about 18K compared to, say, 2K, 4K, whatever. It's absolutely colossal. Also, the other thing is that the IMAX theaters, the bulbs in the projectors are very, very bright. So you get a very bright, high contrast image, much more so than you get even in a standard 35mm cinema. The other thing is IMAX basically then gives you this enormous canvas to work on. And Chris felt that this was entirely appropriate to depict the larger-than-life world of Gotham City. He wanted to work on the biggest possible canvas to give us the maximum possible sense of scale and immersion in the image. And I think it's fair to say that the IMAX image, if you're sitting in the right place in the cinema, gives you an almost three-dimensional effect because it completely fills your vision and bleeds off at both sides, and it's a very, very immersive feeling. I mean, your question about, you know, why not just shoot the whole film in IMAX? I mean, that was something I think that Chris and Wally did contemplate, both on Dark Knight and then again on this film. But the fact of the matter is, it's an expensive process. You know, the cameras are also quite limited for use in dialogue scenes. They're quite noisy. There are no soundproofed IMAX cameras. So if you're wanting to do intimate dialogue, we did tend to drop back into 35mm, into the standard anamorphic cameras. I mean, you have the option of using ADR and re-recording everything afterwards, but that's something that Chris really doesn't like to do. He always tries to use production sound where at all possible.
Well, as I said, this isn't an original thing in the sense that you've done it before, but could you walk me through what I think is one of the most spectacular sequences in the film, which is the opening action sequence. Not exactly the opening shot of the film, but it's close to it. And this was obviously done with a combination of effects, but just to start, could we discuss what the implications were of trying to pull off this aerial footage in IMAX?
Well, the first thing we started with there is we actually spent quite a lot of time planning the whole thing. Obviously, it's in the script. There's a pretty good description of what's actually going on, and there were some really great storyboards were drawn. But it became obvious that we really needed to have much more accurate data on where we were going to be able to place the cameras. You know, were we actually going to even be able to keep up with the aircraft in the chosen helicopter camera ship? So we had to do all sorts of work
because you couldn't have an exterior mount on a helicopter. What, there was an airspeed problem, or?
Well, the helicopters top out at about 120 knots. You know, you can't really go much faster than that, and you certainly can't go those sorts of speeds and maintain stabilization on the camera mount. On the other hand, most of the aircraft we were looking at, their minimum stall speeds were higher than 120 knots. So we'd have this problem that the planes would just go blasting past and we'd be able to maybe pan with them, but it would make it wouldn't make for particularly good shots, and also would have meant that the reset times would have been enormous because the planes have had to keep flying around in big circles to come back to meet the helicopter. But so the stunt department were doing a lot of work to find out, well, what were the minimum speeds these planes could fly at, And then every time they'd give us a new piece of information, we'd rebuild the previs saying, okay, well, if we can get the C-130 down to 115 knots and we can fly the chopper, let's say at 85 knots with the mount fully stabilized, what kind of speed differential does that give us between the aircraft, and will that look any good? And in the end, they found that by extending the flaps on the C-130, they could really slow it down to the point that the helicopter could keep up with it. And also the small turbo prop plane, the Bandita Ante, little grey CIA plane in the sequence. We chose that specifically partly because of its low speed characteristics, and also because of the wing walking that was required from the stunt crew, which again was something that we developed through the previs. And I'd spend time with Tom Struthers, our stunt supervisor, and he'd say, look, you can put the guys here on the plane and do this and do that. And then we'd set up camera angles and offer them up to Chris, and he'd sign off on them. And then, this then all drove the choice of the aircraft.
So talk to me about it from a visual effects point of view. So you had actual guys on actual wires, on mm-hmm. actual sort of, I mean, this is incredibly dangerous to not put it mildly, but there must have been obviously digital and mechanical work.
Yes, absolutely. Well, again, from the previs, we were able to sit down with all of the department heads and work out who was going to be able to do what. What part of it was going to be stunts, special effects, what part was going to be in camera, what was going to have to go to visual effects. And it was great because we had a really clear agreement up front as to what was going to happen. And we also found that just maybe tweaking the previs a little bit, just repositioning the guys as they came out of the aircraft, as they drop out the back of the C-130, it made all the difference between doing something for real and then having to go to a visual effect for it. So when you see the guys tumble out the back of the plane on the wires, that's all in camera.
Right.
We're not doing anything there. I think the one thing we may have done is I'm just trying to remember back. It's so long ago since we completed that. So it's back in the summer last year. We did add the little grey CIA plane in a couple of shots just because it wasn't possible to have it underneath the C-130 sometimes when we were doing those things. And then in terms of the mechanical work, Special Effects built this amazing gimbaled set, which was the fuselage of the turboprop plane. Could then tilt up and down and could pitch and roll. And then we used that for all the interiors with the plane tipping on its end and people falling down through the interior of the plane. And we also made it shootable on the outside. So that's when you see the close-ups of the gunman landing on the wings and attaching the bolts. That's all shot on this set that we built in England. But for things like the big hero shots of the plane being hoisted on its tail and the wings tearing off, that's a combination of live action. We always filmed the C-130. We never had to do a digital C-130. But the Bandit is a combination of a miniature, which we built over at Newport in Array and finished that there. And they rigged that plane with breakaway wings, which we then used to create the moment where the wings tear off. And what you look in the final result is a combination of the miniature, some CG components, reprojection, and extra debris enhancement.
Because I did feel that this had just such a tremendous authenticity to it. I mean, there just were points where the guys were moving away from where the wings were going to break off and the way
yes.
the kind of debris was coming off. It felt so in camera in the way, and I mean this is a complete compliment, that I used to watch James Bond films before we had digital effects. And so it sort of either had to be a miniature or it had to be real. And that
yes.
authenticity just was magnificent in that sequence. Am I right in thinking you actually dropped the fuselage at the end? You actually did drop it?
Yes, absolutely. We all the stuff you see with the stuntmen, the gunmen, should I say, on the outside of the fuselage as it's being suspended underneath the C-130, which is out of frame at this point, that was all shot for real, with a real aeroplane fuselage being suspended underneath a big heavy lift Super Puma helicopter, which we filmed in the skies over the Highlands of Scotland.
With a helicopter cleanup crew to go and pick up the mess afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. So when you see the guys push themselves away and the tailplane blow off the suspended fuselage, that is that's the real fuselage, but we've added a CG tailplane for when it's static, and then when it breaks away, that's the miniature tailplane being blown off. But the guys on the wires, they're for real. and they're all, along with the fuselage, being suspended from underneath the Super Puma.
So, in that shot, it's looking down, and you've got Bane and the guy, he's the Russian that he's taking,
yes,
and that falls away around them. That's actual stuntmen that are having it fall away around them?
Well, that's a practical stunt, yes, with the real fuselage being dropped away down to the ground below. So when you see the thing tumbling away, we did a previs of it, and we designed it to feel a little bit like those fantastic clips from the Apollo missions, you know, where you see stage rocket drop away, and that's exactly what we were going for. And when we dropped the fuselage for real, it pretty much gave us exactly that effect.
You mentioned previs there for a while, but this isn't a director that normally likes to previs his films, is that right?
No, not at all. I mean, on Batman Begins, Chris was very reluctant to use previs, and he uses it very sparingly. I wouldn't want to give the impression that we're prevising half the movie or anything like that. But I think Chris has come to see the value of the technique for working out technical issues, story points, and also just coming up with ideas, which then we can discuss with the whole team.
Well, if I could change gears for a second to an absolutely iconic sequence that we did actually see in the trailer, but in the film is a little longer and a little bigger, which is the football stadium destruction sequence. This is a breathtaking sequence. Was this done with some miniatures? How did you actually pull that off? Because obviously at some point you just don't want to hurt the guys that are either the stuntmen or the real football players that are standing in for the run.
Well, this was something that early on in pre-production I did offer up to Chris, the idea of doing it with a miniature, but to create the destruction, because I felt a miniature, the kind of destruction you can create with a miniature would fit really well with this moment.
Yep.
But it became apparent very quickly that the timings were going to need to be so precise to get this idea of the destruction chasing down the field, chasing after our football players, that... that really the best solution was always going to be digital here, to precisely choreograph things and yet still maintain some sense of believability in the way that the field is collapsing.
Right.
And we did a very extensive previs on this sequence, working out the precise positions of all the players as the destruction catches them up, so that we could then show this to stunts and to construction art department, who then built a platform on the field over at Heinz Field in Pittsburgh. So we had this elevated platform with holes dug into it, which would accommodate our stunt performers as they fall to the ground. And then what we were doing, obviously, is replacing pretty much everything else behind them to create the field, the sense of the field racing up and collapsing, and then they fall into the ground just at the right moment as the field collapses behind them. We did do some practical pyrotechnics on the day. Chris Corbould's team rigged up the whole field with a big series of pyros going off. And whilst we didn't really use any of that in the finished shot, it did set the look and feel for the destruction and the pace of what was actually happening.
So as I've got a player running towards me, and I'm sorry, I'm not a Steelers fan, being an Australian, I can't name the players, but a friend of mine said that they were very well-known people, and I should have known them, even though if I'm an Australian. But anyway, as he's running closer to the camera, what am I seeing if I was there on the day? Is there anything happening behind him, or are there any players behind him?
Yes, we had four players behind. It was Heinz Ward is the name of the Steelers.
Thank you, I'm going to be shot for not knowing that.
Well, I only know it because it's written on his shirt. But yes, he's a huge star in NFL, and particularly in Pittsburgh, which is a very, very big sports town.
Yes.
And so you had Heinz running forward, and then there were four stunt performers chasing after him, who were doing the choreographed dives into the holes.
Right.
But then behind all that, on the actual field itself, we were setting off this series of pyrotechnic detonations, which race up the field, chasing towards the camera. And then we had people in the stands as well. We had about 11,000 people on the day. The production ran a competition to find people who would want to be in the Batman film. But to be honest, I think most of the people who turned up on the day were Steelers fans. of course, what we did is we used the Steelers colours for the Gotham Rogues. So essentially the Gotham Rogues are a sort of parallel universe version of the Pittsburgh Steelers. And But we, and 11,000 people produced, you know, gave us a nice solid block of people in the background, but that stadium seats 80,000 people, so we did have to do quite a bit of crowd extension for the big wide shots.
Right. And in that same sequence when obviously the destruction is going on, we get these wonderful wide shots of the city, which I thought was terrific for two reasons. One, they were just really nice shots with, you could see what was going on. It wasn't like a sort of a super fast cutting montage, but it was all sort of confusing, which I think was an important plot point. But the other thing was, it seemed to me there was a real level of realism in the volume of the volumetrics or the size of the explosions, because obviously from that height, if you're having things implode down, you know, you're not going to have massive fireballs going up right, left and centre. But that seemed to be that there were some building destructions there that kind of reminiscent maybe of what we saw on Inception. Would that be the same kind of pipeline?
Yes, it was. We were using a refined version of the tool set that had been created for Inception, to particularly for the collapse of the buildings into the sea in Limbo City.
Right.
And though actually these, even though these buildings destructions are much, much further away than anything we showed in Inception, the level of detail is considerably higher, because the, you know, the guys have got a lot better at making those tool sets work and have refined the processes and everything. So we were, you know, we were sticking little digital destructions into the cityscape. We were very keen, though, that it's not, you know, Bane's not trying to destroy the city. This is a surgical attack. Yeah. He's precisely laid these charges in a pattern around the city, rather than he's not going out of his way to destroy buildings. That just happens to be something that happens when, you know, the ground collapses beneath a certain building. And then in terms of the actual explosions that you're seeing, for the most part, those are practical pyrotechnic elements that we had filmed actually in the open air against blue skies. So big black powder charges going off and things, and then they're graded and carefully integrated into the aerial cityscapes.
Right, but I presume that, was it a digital volumetric around the bridge explosions, or were, again, they practical elements that you comped into those bridge drops? Because, again, you had only a section of the bridge go.
Sure. Well, for the bridge destructions, no, that's all digital. So the smoke coming off the bridges is digital volumetric smoke created with our squirt fluid system.
The film's pretty dark, but I have to say a lot of it isn't actually in night. It's in overcast, but you get to see a lot of what's going on in this particular Gotham, don't you?
You do indeed, and that was something that was pretty obvious straight away, was that we weren't going to have the luxury of darkness to help hide the joints in the visual effects work. You know, Batman Begins, I'd say 90%, 95% of what we did on that film was in darkness. Dark Knight, it was a slightly lower proportion, but it was still the vast majority of the work was nighttime. This time it was pretty much turned the opposite way around. I think we had maybe three night sequences, only really one substantial night sequence, which is when Batman first gets the bat out and flies it across Gotham. And then the rest of it is daylight, you know. And we are, as you say, it's overcast. We are playing it as winter, though for the most part we actually shot most of those scenes at the height of the summer. So we were then having to do quite a bit of work, both in the photochemical timing and then lots of snow additions to sell those scenes as being winter.
Actually, you really bring up an incredibly important point there, that we're talking about doing these effects at super high resolution, but whereas you may have been expecting to get a bit of a hand from DI, you really lost in gaining all you did with film and this lovely IMAX format. You actually kind of lost that extra safety net of DI being able to digitally grade your master, because you didn't have a full DI on this, did you?
No, we didn't. We didn't use a DI at all. It's interesting, and it's a good point, because you know, when I have worked on films that use DI, which is I guess every film pretty much does that these days, apart from us. It is great to have that extra flexibility. But at the same time, one of the great things about the way that we work on these films is that what we shoot is what we know we're going to be working with. So. You know, we're out on the set, we're filming, and then we see the dailies come back the next day. Wally has already called printer lights on those dailies, so when we see the daily print, that's what we're pretty much going to have in the movie. It's the look is set by what Wally does on set rather than by what he's doing in the lab later on.
It really is hard to imagine a world where you can't change saturation in the grade of the film. Now, obviously, you could when the films were digitized, but nevertheless, like... That simple operation, you're down to color timing by printer lights.
That's it. Yes, exactly. We're just controlling exposure of the different lights. So yes, there is no saturation control or contrast control. It's we're working with what's in the original negative and leaving it as it is. So, but you know what it is. It means you're committing to a decision earlier on, and this is how films used to be made. You know, people used to make decisions on set, and then that'd be it. You know, when you came back from your shoot, you would make your film from what was in the can, rather than continually building on top of it later on digitally.
Because when we spoke before about doing this, we're talking like 70mm 15 perf, right, on the big stuff. We spoke about you digitizing that, and I might get you to repeat what the process was on that. But also, I'd be really interested in the film out process on this as well, because everything gets affected right down to the laser film recorder out, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, what we do is, in terms of setting the grades, obviously, like I say, we have the daily print, and that is the master grade, essentially. That's our first grade. And our grading process in visual effects consists of being sent physical match clips pulled from the dailies print. In the past, we used to stick this onto a light box, and then you'd project the digital image from the raw scan, and then you would grade it digitally until it visibly matched what you could see on the light box. This time around, we refined that process, and we took the grading clips and we actually put them onto a flatbed scanner and scanned them, put them through a proprietary lookup table, which then gave us a digital file which you could put side by side on the screen with the raw scan. And you're still having to eyeball it. You know, it's not an automated process. It's not going to work out the difference automatically and apply it to the digital file. But it gives you something. You're comparing apples for apples on the same screen in the same in the same environment. And this meant we got extremely accurate grades this time. And the grading's all done in a proprietary system that Double Negative has built over the last few years, but which essentially does a lot of the same things that you get with your usual DI grading tools. But the difference here is that we are not trying to use this as a tool to apply an extra creative layer of grading over the top of our digital images. We are using it to emulate what has been achieved photochemically in the lab by Wally and David Orr, who's the color timer over at Technicolor.
Right.
And in terms of getting it back out to film, well, you know, we set the grades digitally, and we do a lot of wedge testing to make sure that when we're recording it back out through the laser recorders or through the IMAX recorders, we're getting what we expect to get. And then obviously you're still at the mercy of lab variants, you know, and the bath can swing a little bit one way or another. But this time around, it was pretty amazingly accurate. And whereas grading had always been a bit of an issue in the past on these films, you know, in terms of getting the digital grades to match the photochemical grades, this time around we didn't really have any problems at all, which I think is largely down to this new system and the skill of the colorists who are working with us.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting problem, isn't it? Because you've got this desire to take the visual effects and make them real. I mean, in some respects, some of the stuff you're doing is fake. And I guess this enters an area that I'd love to sort of swing if we can to, which is this idea of your ability to do something in visual effects that is breaking the laws of physics, but you've set up such a realistic palette for yourself in the sense that the film is realistic, the filming sort of style is realistic, even the framing and stuff is so realistic. I'm just going to choose the bat bike, the pod. It does some really cool maneuvers, and the one I'm going to just use as an example is it does this kind of 90-degree turn, which we had seen before, but you're presented with a problem now that you've got to get it to do something that I know something can't do in a kind of conceptual sense, but you're so draped in realism that you don't have the kind of get out of jail free card I would give maybe another film in of a sort of superhero genre that, you know, is much more fanciful and much more sort of ridiculous and people are just sort of breaking the laws of physics right, left and center. How does that sort of affect your animators, and how do you sort of go about that as a supervisor? Because you're bending without trying not to break, I guess.
Well, you tread a very fine line, really. You look at something and you say, okay, well, we are going to do something inherently unreal, but you try and give it as much realism as possible. So you spend a lot of time observing what the real vehicles are actually doing, the way that the parts move. You spend a lot of time surveying the locations, making sure that you've got all of the undulations in the road surface mapped properly so that Even if you are doing something a little bit fanciful, you are doing something that's being affected by the real conditions that were on the set on the day. At the end of the day, it really does come down to the skill of the animators, and we work with some very, very talented people who I think are some of the best technical vehicle animators in the business. That is a real skill as well. I think obviously a lot of attention is given to creature and character animation, but I think getting a car to look convincing as it skids around a corner and it's leaning over hard on the suspension is an equally difficult thing, and there's not that many people that can really do it, and I'm lucky that we had some of those guys on our team. One of the other things, though, that's really interesting, and I've noticed with all of these films, is that in terms of the audience suspending their disbelief for these moments where we are breaking the rules, I think you get a certain number of free passes. If you're doing everything for real, as we do, as much as possible, with real stunts and real vehicles doing all the crazy action that you see in camera, when you then pop out to something which is breaking those rules, I think so long as it's rendered, in other words, its visual quality is as good as you can possibly make it, and it matches the original photography, the audience will accept something where the action is perhaps pushing into the just into the unrealistic a little bit. And so sometimes things that I think, moments that perhaps would have been would have not worked had it been in a big long run of equally unreal things. If you stick one of these into a sequence where everything else is real, you can get away with it, surprisingly, more easily than you might think.
So the sequences that we've got with the bike, I know you had practical bikes that people were on at various times. I've seen that in production unit photography, but in the earlier films, I imagined you had a stuntman that was doubling pretty well for Christian Bale, which is fair enough. I mean, he's a good actor. But now you've got a woman who's riding these bikes. Was there just a particularly curvaceous stunt woman riding this, or was she all digital? I mean, I don't sound sort of sexist or anything, but I mean, it's just like a lot harder to find someone, anyone, that has those kind of proportions.
Well, there was a bit of a it was a worry at the beginning of pre-production was that, how were we going to double for Catwoman on the Batpod, because the Batpod is an extremely difficult vehicle to ride, and really we don't have found one stunt rider that could actually do this. It's this amazing French rider, Jean-Pierre Goy. But stunts came up with the goods and actually got a female rider who could move the hurl the Batpod around in pretty convincing fashion. So Jolene, who's our stunt rider for the Batpod, did an absolutely amazing job. Special effects also did some work to refine the Batpod. I believe they lightened it considerably. They took several hundred pounds of metal off the thing, and made it altogether a bit easier to handle. But still, you're looking at the two people who can ride this thing. There is nobody else can make this thing work in the way that Jean-Pierre and Jolene can. For our digital Catwoman, we built a digital stunt double of Christian for the moments where the Batpod is doing its wheel flips and it does a ramp jump at one point. And we did the same thing for the more extreme moments of the Catwoman's Batpod action. So there's a scene where the Batpod jumps over a crash tumbler. There's another one where it pulls a 180 hairpin turn with the wheels flipping over. And those are digital moments. We're using our digital Catwoman at that point.
I've got to say, Paul, I think that the quality of the rendering in this was just superb, because obviously there are some things that had to be digital. I mean, I know that because, you can't fly the Batman's helicopter. You can't fly that thing for real. You can have some on wires, but it's clearly at some point it had to be digital, and clearly the bike the same way. But man, you guys seem to be nailing it in the rendering. Was there anything different there?
Thank you. Well, we rolled out a new shading system, which implements some of the new features in the latest versions of RenderMan, which basically we moved everything over to a fully ray-traced, physically-based rendering setup that does correct conservation of energy as light rays bounce back and forth between surfaces and are reflected off different materials. So we don't get any kind of false notes in terms of surfaces returning more light than they're supposed to be, than they would do in the real world. Which in the past was always something that we had to manually control, but now it's doing it in a physically correct fashion. And this just gave everything a much greater level of inherent believability than we'd had in the past. And I think it was really vital that we had this system because of all the daylight work that we talked about earlier on. But what it does rely on is very, very extensive look development. And one of the great things this time around was that, you know, having been through three films previously with Chris and the rest of the crew, I think there is an understanding that we do need time to get our HDRI reference on set. We have our own little panoramic HDRI camera system, which is four digital SLRs mounted in a case, driven by a proprietary computer system.
So just to ask you that, how do you get around the nodal problem if you've got four in a case? Aren't they all backing at each other and nodally offsetting? I mean, I would imagine that... I mean, I know that the spheron solves that by just having a rotating column.
Yes. Well, you know, you get into problems if stuff is very, very close to the camera. But for the most part, you know, we're capturing great big cityscape environments. We're sticking the camera in the middle of an intersection and the buildings are... you know, at least 50, 60 feet away.
Right.
And the offset problems you get there are negligible and they don't really make any significant difference. So we get away with it. If we did need something where we absolutely needed to be nodal, then we wouldn't use that system. We'd actually just stick a camera in there on a nodal mount.
Now, were you then LiDAR scanning these streets? Because this is a heck of a survey problem.
Yes, we did. Well, the way that we worked out this is back on Batman Begins, rather than try and... you know, LiDAR everything in Chicago. We worked out that to build Gotham, what we really needed was an architectural library of buildings. So we chose a series of hero buildings in Chicago and we modeled those. And we did exactly the same thing this time round. But this time the architecture was all based off Pittsburgh. Because a lot of our action was going to be filmed in Pittsburgh, but we were also filming in Los Angeles and filming in New York. And so we wanted a library of Pittsburgh buildings that we could use to dress into the Los Angeles and New York locations in order to sort of bridge the gap so that everything's thematically connected architect.
Right.
And we surveyed Smithfield Street in Pittsburgh and built pretty much all of the buildings from a sort of six-block stretch of Smithfield Street in downtown Pittsburgh.
And I mentioned the bat, the helicopter that takes off. How did you go for? Because you needed to get high on those buildings. How did you go about doing that? And was that a digital set that I was watching it fly through, or was it? How does that work?
Well, it's an interesting story behind that because in the script, the big end sequence where Batman's chasing the bomb truck in the using the bat. Really is just covered by a couple of lines. It just basically says Batman appears in the bat, slides in behind the truck, and a rolling battle ensues. You know, that's it. So we went off, and again, using Previs, this time we were using Previs to kind of come up with story points, action beats, as it were. And we knew what the dimensions of the streets in Pittsburgh were going to be. We knew how many vehicles we were going to have. We knew the range of motion that the... that the physical bat was going to be able to manage mounted on this hydraulic lift on a vehicle. And we started coming up with ideas for action moments, and then I strung this all together into a little mini movie, like a little 5-minute presentation, and put it in front of Chris, and you know, some of it he liked and some of it he didn't, and all of it was informed by conversations that we were having with stunts and special effects. So all of the sort of street level stuff, we were trying to keep it within the realms of possibility, what we could actually physically film on the day. But then Chris had this idea of, well, what about if one of the tumblers fired some missiles at the bat and Batman has to dodge these on the street? And I'm not entirely sure who came up with the idea. I think it was from visual effects. We said, well, what about if these missiles are heat seekers and then maybe they could chase the bat, forcing the bat to come up and out of the street and fly across the rooftops trying to scrape these missiles off against the buildings. And, you know, which would show that the bat is more than just a street-level vehicle and also show that it's capable of a real turn of speed, which is something that we needed to be able to show later on, as well as showing off its maneuverability. And so we laid this out, and I really didn't give a second thought to how we were going to achieve the environments for this sequence, because I figured, well, you know, we're going to build all these buildings. We can do this as a digital environment. But
What actually happened is when we got to Chicago, got to Pittsburgh. Sorry, I keep saying Chicago. When we got to Pittsburgh, we had low fly permissions for several of the streets there with the aerial unit. So I spent a lot of time with the aerial unit, the helicopter, basically flying back up and down the streets of Pittsburgh, weaving across the rooftops in between the skyscrapers, and getting a whole library of background plates, which then we laid out our digital bat onto these plates. And we did this very, very quickly in Nuke, actually using the 3D tools in Nuke, rather than doing it initially in Maya. It was partly because of availability of Maya animators at that point within our team, but also we found that we could do this extremely quickly and turn stuff around very, very fast, put it back in front of Chris, and he could try it out in the cut and tell us whether it was going to work or not. And through this process, eventually, obviously, we replaced the Nuke animations with proper Maya animations and started refining the action of the bat. But the result is that that whole aerial sequence, all of those background environments, you know, the rooftops and everything, they're all 100% real. You know, we managed to film everything, and we were just using CG to create the flying vehicles and the rockets.
So did you have a gyron mount? I mean, what was the mount that you had on the... on the chopper for that, do you remember? Was it a...
It was an Eclipse.
An Eclipse. Because so, the reason I ask that is because if you've got an IMAX camera on one of those really great, don't get me wrong, they're terrific camera stabilizers, but you would have had a relatively small magazine, wouldn't you? So the load time would dictate a relatively short flying time, is that right?
Pretty much, yes. We were using the Eclipse, and it was one of the MSM IMAX cameras inside there. We had a special... Right. Yeah, I think it's a 1,000-foot mag we were using there. So
how many minutes does that give you?
That's about 2 minutes. and that also includes your slating as well. So really, you're looking more at about 1 minute 45.
You'd want to do some of the fastest slating in history.
Yes, you'd do it pretty quickly. And then we'd obviously have to get back down onto the LZ, which is on the roof of a parking garage in downtown Pittsburgh, and then reload. So yes, lots and lots of reloads.
You must have got to know that that roof of that car park pretty well.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it was actually right next to the hotel that I was staying in, so I could look into my hotel window every time we came in for a landing.
So so you wouldn't have been able to get on top of rooftops to do HDRs. Was this therefore matched lighting just by your good team at DNEG? Or?
Well, we did get HDRs on rooftops.
Oh, good.
Obviously, we weren't necessarily getting them at the same time we were actually shooting with the helicopter. But fortunately, the weather in Pittsburgh was pretty consistent the whole time we were there in terms of the lighting conditions. So what we'd do is we'd make a note of what time we'd been up there with the helicopter. And then the guys would, when they could, they'd get back up onto the roof at the right time of day and get HDRIs. But in the end, we were building up a large library of HDRI environments. And then you could say, okay, well, what's the best match to what we're seeing in the plate here? And then, of course, you know, you do a little bit of work repainting and rebalancing what's in the HDRI to get a result which is as close as you needed to the original plate photography. But again, at the end of the day, it all comes down to the skill of the lighting team. You know, the HDRI tools allow us to achieve an incredibly realistic result, but none of it works without the creative eye and the artistry of the guys that are running the systems.
So those are for the shots we're talking about where it's like banking away from the missile launch. But in the earlier sequence, when we first get the bat seen in anger, well, not in anger, but in the sense that he's escaping from about basically all of the Gotham police force that are chasing him at night, which is the night of the attack on the stock exchange. Am I right in thinking that what came out of the alleyway there was not your digital model, but an actual rig? Is that right?
Yes, that's it. Yeah, it's the physical bat on a cable rig. So when it comes sliding out of the alleyway there, shooting out of the alleyway, that's a physical bat. What we did, of course, obviously, was the rig removal, taking out the wires and things. And we augmented it, we added a few bits of moving control surfaces, so flaps that are moving around. We gave it a little bit of extra stuff here and there. And then when you see the final shot as it flies away from us, that again, it's the bat on the wire rig. We're doing a little bit of work to enhance its movement and its action and give it a bit more speed as it takes off.
So how complex would you rate the overall wire removal and rig removal on this film? Was it relatively easy? Because I know Inception, you had some really tricky stuff.
This was pretty hard. This was at least on a par with the Inception stuff.
Really?
Of course, you know, IMAX complicates it significantly.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, again, we were shooting a lot of this stuff in real world locations. You know, we don't have the luxury of green screen. And Chris and Wally move incredibly quickly. You know, and the IMAX cameras didn't slow them down at all. So, you know, a lot of the rig removals come down to, again, just amazing skill and dedication from the roto and rig removal crews.
So some of these sequences we're talking about would have been shot 8K, and even if they were at 5.6K in the pipe, how does an artist sitting at their desk get to play back? Because one of the tricks for people that may have done heaps of roto is that it can look great on a still frame, but when it plays, something just kind of catches your eye. But you shrink it right down, and that doesn't catch your eye anymore. Now, I was sitting in a cinema where this thing was about the size of a planet in front of me projected on IMAX. How do they review that? Is it in tiles or...?
Well, the great thing now is obviously the computers have now got fast enough and the memory sizes are large enough that we can hold the whole frame, the 5.6K frame. You can flip the whole thing. But obviously the monitor, the display system, is only showing you a 2K window into what's going on there. So you can zoom out and look at the whole thing, or you can push in and look on individual bits of it, essentially looking at tiles. But so you can study the individual areas of the image and say, okay, well, that's working or that's not working, whatever. But ultimately, it comes down to developing a feel for it, because that does slow the process down, loading up the huge, you know, the full frame renders. And, you know, it's an extra layer of complication. And really, you've just got to develop a feel for this sort of thing. And it's very similar to the way that we worked 20 years ago when we first started working with standard definition television images. And, you know, we couldn't really view those things in real time. You know, the computers weren't powerful enough back in the early 90s to do that. So you'd always be previewing it sort of postage stamp resolution. And you'd say, okay, well, I've got a pretty good feeling that this is all going to work and I know my anti-aliasing is set up correctly. This is a predictable process. And so it's developing those sorts of, you know, level of expectation that level of reliability.
But isn't there still one difference between those? I mean, it's a good analogy and I'm with you, but the big difference here is, like, in those old days, let's say you were supervising a film, you could do a film out. You could go into a theatre at Dean Egg, maybe, or whatever, and play the film out, because having a 35mm projector at your office, while expensive, was possible. But you don't have an IMAX, or do you, at Dean Egg in London?
No, we don't. No, that's the, option.
How did you personally approve a shot?
Ultimately, the person who finally has to approve the shot is Chris Nolan, and so he was quite often the first person to see these things at target resolution on IMAX, because you know, to film out to IMAX is a very laborious process. We had to ship the picture over to Los Angeles. It's filmed out in Santa Monica, and then the print is shipped back to the UK. We have to then get a slot over at the BFI IMAX on the South Bank, the big IMAX theater there. So we didn't do that often. We would, we maybe did IMAX dailies, I don't know, maybe in the UK, maybe twice during post-production. And, I was spending a lot of time shuttling back and forth across the Atlantic to look at things with Chris. But again, that's once every 2 or 3 weeks. So it's not a daily process. So again, it's really about, you know, when you do get to see it on IMAX, you say, oh, okay, great. I understand how this thing worked out.
It seems to me that when you and I are talking a couple of times now over the years, we've got back to the quality of the team in your Dean Egg wire removal group, because it really is, it's only when you start laying this stuff out, you get to appreciate that if these guys weren't really checking their work very, very well, this stuff would become apparent at exactly when you don't want it to become apparent, when somebody's filmed it out to IMAX and the director sitting in a theatre.
No, absolutely. No, we would obviously, we had a lot of layers of safety checks. You know, the artists obviously themselves are checking all their work, and they understood that it was very important to not just to say, okay, well, I think this is all going to work at high resolution, that they had to be testing it in some sort of meaningful fashion to check that things were working out. You know, I would, shots that I knew were going to be a challenge, I would spend a lot of time scrutinizing them myself on my own machine. And the leads obviously are checking, and then ultimately our 2D and VFX supervisors are acting as the final stage. And everything before we filmed anything out, we'd put it on the biggest screen we possibly could digitally to check it, because you get a different feeling for things when you see them projected really large, even if it's just at the same resolution as what you're seeing on your monitor. But it's, you know, a lot of it's down to the fact that the guys, it's the same team that we worked with on Inception, on Batman Begins, on The Dark Knight. So there's a lot of experience between all of us now about how to make these things work.
And I guess sort of related to wire removal is integrating the miniatures. And we mentioned, I think, that there were two sequences that were shot with miniatures. We've already talked about one of them, which was the plane. So just for those that are playing along at home, what was the other sequence that incorporated miniatures?
It's the scene where Bane blows out the roof of his lair, his underground lair, where he's sort of holed up down in this big sort of chamber in the sewers underneath Gotham. And after he's defeated Batman in hand-to-hand fighting, he then sets off the charges that his men have been laying all around Gotham City, and it blows out the ceiling of this room. And as it collapses, you then realize you can now see up into applied sciences, you know, the research and development division of Wayne Enterprises, and a full-size tumbler falls through. And so we had two things. We dropped a real tumbler into the real set that was built in Cardington in the UK, this huge aircraft hangar that we filmed all of these movies in. And Corbold rigged it up to drop one of the Batmobiles painted up in military colours through this set, which is, you know, it's a 100-odd-foot drop, and it slammed down onto the floor. But the set never had a ceiling on it. So for when we were looking up and actually seeing the ceiling, we did this as a third-scale miniature, dropping a third-scale Batmobile miniature into the set, which was shot over at, again, over at New Deal Studios in Marina Del Rey. And the Tim Angulo, who's the VFX DP, miniatures DP over at New Deal, him and his guys did a tremendous job matching the lighting of the set back in the UK. So I think it's a pretty much seamless match. You wouldn't know that you were going from a full-size set to a third-scale miniature. And then we also used the same miniature to show the aftermath, the hole in the ceiling, and to see the mercenaries clambering up into it, which we did. We shot those guys separately on against a green screen, and then reduce them in scale and comp them into the miniature.
Well, look, it's a terrific film and just an amazing trilogy. It's one of those rare, you know, films that doesn't in any way suffer from just going over the ground that it's been over before. And it's just congratulations. And, you know, personally, I think you've just done such a spectacular job on it. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us about it.
Oh, thank you very much, Mike. No, it's been a real privilege working on these films, to work with such an amazing team of people, and to create something hopefully which will stand the test of time and people will still be watching in years to come. And it's been great being able to tell everybody about it here on FX Guide.
Thanks so much.
All right. Take care.
Well, thanks for that, guys. I really just have to give a shout out to Paul Franklin. A big thank you, because he's been so generous with his time and sharing of information and knowledge and over the years with FX Guide and the FX podcast. And I know he's one of our favorite guests. I hear about from people when they talk about the FX podcast, and I'm really glad we got to bring you this one. Before we close out, I'd like to thank our FX Insider members who support the site through their contributions. As a thanks for donations made as part of the FX Insider program, we give access to exclusive additional content. Things like member-only articles, additional FX breakdowns, and more. Details are at fxguide.com. Click the FX Insider tab. In addition to this FX podcast, we do two other regular audio podcasts. The first one is the VFX Show, which reviews visual effects and current releases, as well as classic films. And the RC Podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. And also, as I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, check out our FX Guide TV. It's a high-def video podcast, and our sister site, FX PhD, is featured very prominently in a current episode explaining the new term coming up. So that'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, we'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.